You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Today is Wednesday, January 30th, 2008, and welcome to episode 4 of the Wells Tech Podcast. I'm Martin Spriggs.
And I'm Sally Draper.
And we are your hosts for this half hour of technology and ministry talk. Sally, good morning. How are things in Sleepy Eye today?
Sleepy Eye is experiencing wind chills of 35 below. This Mississippi girl doesn't know what to do in those kind of numbers.
We have the same over here. In fact, all schools were canceled, or most schools were canceled today. Roads were fine, but boy, that's tough for kids to stand out on the curb and wait for a bus in.
You bet.
Hey, I was wondering as I asked you about Sleepy Eye, how Sleepy Eye got its name? Is it really sleepy?
I'm tired all the time here. No, actually, it's an old Indian name. It's a very famous Indian. We have a statue in town for Chief
so is it
Sleepy
Chief,
Eye.
Chief Sleepy Eye,
yeah,
is that right?
His eye, no one kidding. Of his eyes actually drooped, so that's how his name came about.
Well, it sounds better than droopy eye.
Yeah.
Well, our prayer today is that our show will be anything but sleepy. I'm pretty excited, actually, about the upcoming interview with Harvey Dunn today. He's going to join us, and he's a lawyer, a Wells lawyer. He talks about some copyright issues. Now, that may not sound like edge-of-your-seat kind of stuff, but it's probably a question I get asked almost daily by churches and schools, just a real complicated subject of copyright and privacy. So we're going to talk to Harvey a little bit later on about that. We'd also love for you to participate in the show, and that's easy to do. The best way to do it is simply visit wellstech.wells.net and click on the Contact Us tab. There are multiple ways that you can join us. One of those ways is by using the Wells Tech listserv or mailing list. Last week, we mentioned an item that was posted on that Wells Tech mailing list by Pastor Rick Cron regarding recording and broadcasting their worship services. There was a tremendous response to Rick's questions, and I know many churches out there are beginning to struggle with some of those same questions about the best way to record video and audio within the worship setting.
Actually, we've just dipped our toe in the water in that area as well. Our local cable TV station allows us to broadcast our services each week. So we've just started with kind of a bare minimum setup and explored different options and finally decided to buy a prosumer camera to use here, kind of a high-end camera with some special features so that we get a really good quality video produced from the camera. And we're really happy with the results. We're on TV each week, and we're also posting audio only on the internet so people can listen to the sermons if they want to catch up on a sermon that they missed or whatever.
Yeah, I guess that's the big question that congregations really need to ask. Why do you do it? Why do you want to do it? And if you're going to do it, what are some of the considerations? As you were thinking about doing it, what process did you go through to kind of figure out what to do?
Well, I think, knowing what your audience is, if it's web only versus television or whatever, is going to drive some of the decisions that you make. Also, knowing what kind of production time you have. If you don't have a huge group of volunteers willing to spend hours on post-production process, then you're going to need a solution that's pretty much ready to go right out of the camera or whatever. So all of those were considerations. For us, we wanted to have a really high-quality picture on the television, so we went with a Canon GL2 prosumer camera, and it has something called 3CCD. That's a big deal when you start talking about cameras. The CCD is the sensor that picks up the picture, and normally most consumer level cameras at least only have one of those sensors, but with this higher level camera you get the sensors, three different ones that pick up the three different color variations, and it makes for just a super high quality picture. Beyond that, then you need to think about how you're going to output that. What kind of format do you need it? Digitally, so you can put it on the web, maybe an AVI format, convert it to Flash or Windows Media, or do you need it, in a media that you can deliver, either VHS or DVD recording? And if so, there's obviously more equipment involved, more software involved, that kind of thing.
So you're taking it from the camera, I assume it's recording to a tape, a mini DV tape or something like that, hooking that up to your computer via USB or FireWire, and then digitizing it that way, and then doing whatever little editing you want to do.
Actually, we're not doing any web broadcasting or web versions of it yet. So we're actually recording directly from the camera to a high-end VHS DVD recorder, and taking it right out of that recorder and delivering it to the television station. But the method you described would be the way we'd do it if we needed to do a web version, if we needed it digitally.
Yeah, there's a lot of considerations there, and I think many congregations are going that route where they're going straight from the camera into a computer, and that's there's a couple ways to do that. You can use a prosumer camera like the one that you talked about, Sally, and hook that up directly to a computer via cable. And then the computer is actually doing the recording. You can also use devices, go to tape like you're doing as well. Some congregations are doing this because they wanted live broadcast, so they have to get it into the computer to get it out on the Internet. So the computer is connected to the Internet via a broadband connection right there in the worship facility, and then they're broadcasting that out. There are a couple different, I think, challenges to doing that. First of all, you need the right, you need the area to do that. And then also, when you're putting up your cameras, you ultimately need to be sensitive to the worship experience. One camera that I've recommended to a number of congregations is a camera by Sony. It's the EVI D70. And that is not a prosumer camera. It's not even a consumer camera. It's essentially a dumb lens that can be remote controlled. So there's no tape to it. It's not like your camcorder. It's basically a camera that you hook up with a cable to your computer, and then you have another cable, a Visca cable. It's kind of a serial connection that allows you to remote control that camera, from your computer. So it can pan and tilt and zoom. That way you can kind of hide these cameras, put it in a transept or under a balcony, something like that, so it's a little bit out of the way, but it still gives the perspective that you're viewing the speaker, whether that be the pastor or the liturgist or whoever, from a decent perspective. And you can chain these cameras together so that you can do some switching, and there's software to do that. These cameras are a little bit on the high end. They're fairly expensive. They run $800 to $1,000, but it is an investment. For those congregations that are really serious about the quality, that's probably an area where they're going to sink some money. Also, on the sound side, it's really important to get good sound equipment. Good pictures is one thing, but really it's the audio that's important to capture accurately, and ultimately, whether that be for cable broadcast or for over the Internet, it's really important to get good sound, and that sound needs to come right into the computer or the device that's doing the recording as well. Any other things that you're thinking of doing there, Sally, with the equipment that you have?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, we are putting audio only out on the web so that people can listen to the sermons, and we're actually recording that separately using a digital recording device. And again, that one of our major considerations is the post-production time, not having time on Sunday afternoon to do a lot of work with these files. We want to be able to just take them from the recording right to delivery, and so we don't want to have to take the time to strip the audio off of the video production or whatever. This way we have just a separate audio file. We can get it on the computer and get it up on the web fairly quickly with that method. So that's kind of a bare minimum to get started with audio-video delivery, just doing some audio recordings with a digital audio recorder.
Yeah, and that bare minimum, I think we need to encourage our listeners to raise the bar pretty high. Really, why you're putting this out there on your website, at least, would be to allow the the church shopper, let's say, to have kind of an immersive experience, when to get a sense for what it's like to worship there. And if you've got kind of grainy video, lousy audio, lighting's not great, the angle's bad, let's say you can only put a camera, kind of a profile view, of the pulpit, and that's not going to give that immersive experience that I think you're after. And a lot of church shoppers are not visiting churches at this point. They're going on websites, viewing videos, listening to audios, and they're making some determinations about whether they will even visit that congregation based on that online visit that they've made. So it's really important to pay attention to quality. And if you're not quite there, if you don't have everything down, I would say, better to wait, and then throw something out there that's not, really done with excellence. You're really representing the church. And that's a decision point for those who want to visit. So make sure that that's being done well. So there's lots of considerations, and you could probably spend a lot of time talking about all the ins and outs. But there are some good resources out there, and I think that, as we move forward with these podcasts, that's an issue that's going to be coming up again and again, how best to do this. And if you're interested, take a look at that conversation on the Wells Tech listserv. It's all archived there, and you can kind of see some of the responses and some of the tools and suggestions that are being made there, some great stuff. There's also some good free stuff that's recommended there, too. So it doesn't have to cost you an arm and a leg, at least in some areas, to do this with quality. And then look at some good examples as far as programming and camera angles and those kinds of things. So a great resource, at least when it comes to producing quality video and audio, is available via a video series called Lights, Camera, Produce, a series put out by Media Services here in the Senate office. It's available on Streams, so that's streams.wells.net. Just do a quick search for Lights, Camera, Produce, or Lights. It should come up, segmented into all kinds of different helpful little videos that could be helpful to you in trying to produce some good quality stuff.
Sure, this is probably a topic we could revisit in a couple of months and see how things are going, because the technology changes so quickly, and obviously as you begin to do this type of work, you're going to learn things along the way, and you're going to improve, over time, and just lots of potential there.
Sally, one of the things that comes up a lot when you're talking about broadcasting are copyright issues. And fortunate for us, we were able to get Harvey Dunn on the show. He's a Wells member and a lawyer down in one of our Texas congregations. And his specialty is in intellectual property, or in common man's terms, copyright issues. So we were fortunate to have Harvey on. We're going to split his interview into a couple sections because it's such a complicated topic. So let's listen to Harvey Dunn. Joining us today is Wells member and lawyer Harvey Dunn. Welcome, Harvey. Thanks for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Harvey, can you tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started here?
Well, sure. First of all, probably most importantly, at least to me, I am a Wells member and have been a Wells member for, a very long time. And in addition, I guess relevant to this program, I am a lawyer and I practice in the area of intellectual property law. And intellectual property basically is an area of the law that covers copyrights, patents, trademarks, trade secrets, and that sort of intellectual property as opposed to real property or personal property. And I've been practicing in this area for about 25 years.
I would assume with the advent of the internet and the advances of technology, that's a whole different ballgame as far as intellectual property is concerned.
Well, it is, and in one sense and in another sense it isn't. It has raised new issues, but the law itself really hasn't changed. So what you end up doing is trying to apply concepts and law that maybe was more adapted to covering hand copying artwork to what we do now on the internet. And so it makes a bit of a challenge sometimes, but the principles are still basically the same as they were 100 years ago.
So what, as you view work in the congregations and some of the copyright and liability issues that congregations and maybe schools need to be aware of? What are some of those issues, especially as it relates to maybe to websites today?
Well, obviously copyright is probably the primary area where people encounter legal issues. There are also legal issues with respect to the right of privacy, how much information can I and should I as a congregation disclose on my website with respect to my members. As a part of copyright, if I use images or artwork or text, how do I either attribute that to the proper source or get permission to use it?
So do congregations then, we talked about pictures, and I know there's a sensitive area there as far as children are concerned, adults as well. Do congregations need permission to post pictures of members, whether they be adult or children, on their public websites?
Well, let me start with the concept of need as sort of a vague word. You know, are you legally required to have permission is one question. Is it advisable to get permission is another. And in answering that, you really have to ask yourself, well, what, with respect to my website, with respect to the congregation's website, what aspects are public and what aspects maybe are private where you have to use a password or something like that to access them. If you're talking about a public website where anybody in the world can literally click on a link and get to the information and photographs and that sort of thing, while it's not legally required, certainly even for adults, I would think that a congregation would be wise in getting written permission with respect to the pictures of the members that are posted in that area. And it could be pictures of a congregational activity. It could be individual pictures, even posting pictures of the church secretary. There probably ought to be written permission. Now, is it legally required? No. Is it likely to be an issue? Probably not, but would it be best practice to go ahead and get permission? Yes.
So you're not differentiating between an individual photo and, let's say, a group or an activity photo?
Well, the larger the group, the less of an issue it becomes. And so if I have a picture from the back of my church looking forward where I get the backs of the entire congregation's heads as a part of a worship service, well, there's going to be very, very minimal concern there, and frankly, practically no concern regarding posting that sort of picture on the web. The more identifiable the person, the more and the more information you provide with respect to that person, the more there is an issue. So if I have a picture of an adult Bible class showing 30 people sitting in that class and there's no additional information given, that's probably not going to be a problem either. On the other hand, if I have a picture of the winners of the church chili cook-off and I'm providing the names and that sort of thing, that's an area where it becomes, again, more identifiable information. And I may want to go ahead at that point and say, are you okay with posting a picture with the identifying information on the web? You're likely not, going to get an "yeah, that's fine with me" response. And if that's the case, you can go ahead and say, "Well, would you mind just signing this?" Or I'll send you an email, and you can respond saying it's okay. It doesn't have to be real formal, but the more identifying information you give, the more of a privacy concern that gets raised, and so the more conscious you should be of getting permission.
So kind of a handshake agreement probably isn't going to do it. You'd probably want something, maybe it doesn't have to be super formal, but something that can be referenced, later on.
Exactly. And frankly, the likelihood in a church context of this ever coming up as an issue is very, very low, particularly if you're dealing with adults. Now, when you're dealing with children, I think you need a heightened sense of sensitivity with respect to what gets posted and what identifying information gets posted. But with respect to adults, the likelihood of an issue is very, very low. Again, best practice would say that if I'm posting names and faces, and certainly if I go beyond that with addresses or something like that, I should get permission. Does it have to be formal? No. I mean, an email to and from a person saying, "Are you okay with us posting this on our website?" And a response that says, "Yes," is going to be sufficient to alleviate, I think, most concerns.
Harvey, are there other privacy concerns we should be aware of besides photos? Things like you mentioned addresses, phone numbers, that kind of thing?
Well, I think in this day and age, one needs to be sensitive to any information that is generally available from one's website that deals with any sort of personal information. So if we're talking about anything from email addresses to, I mean, we've all, I suspect, have experienced spam and that sort of thing on coming in through our email. And obviously, public posting of email addresses, you know, can be an issue in that regard. So I think, again, just prudence and not so much from a legal perspective, but just taking care in terms of what's posted. You know, is it necessary to be posted in a completely public fashion? And I would suggest that, you know, email addresses are things that probably other than an email address for the church, an email address perhaps for the pastor and that sort of thing. Individual email addresses generally are things that one should steer away from in terms of public posting. Now, I think you have a different issue if you're posting it and the postings are protected by a password. For example, you have on your website an area that can only be accessed by members of the congregation. That's an area where I think you have a lot more flexibility, and that's where you might post a member list, for example, where everybody could go get the most up-to-date addresses and that sort of thing for members of the congregation. But in terms of a public availability, I think you just need to be conscious that there are not so much legal issues, but issues with respect to just do I want to get a lot of spam or unsolicited emails and that sort of thing that suggests that one may not, you know, just be aware when you post information, is it necessary to have this available in a public forum?
I know a number of our congregations like to post, let's say, their newsletters or there are even service folders with announcements, and those contain names. And I know when you potentially would do a search, you know, on the internet, you know, on a person's name, that kind of information might come up. Would you recommend to congregations that they strip that out, or maybe not publish in a public space those newsletters and church service folders?
Well, let me start by saying I think the legal issues involved are fairly minimal. Again, I think the concern would be in our newsletter, for example, we may have the winners of the Pioneers.
Right. Soapbox Derby
whatever. Right. And so you have in your newsletter both adult information, information relating to adults, and also information relating to children. And as a result, you may not want to post the entire newsletter, or you may want to post it in a way that it's not searchable. You can certainly, in posting a newsletter, do it as a JPEG file or something like that, where it's simply an image, which makes the ability for somebody to search the information in a Google search impossible.
That's a great idea.
So I think there are ways you can get around it. Obviously, you may just want to post certain parts of the newsletter if you're going to do it in a searchable fashion, or post it behind a wall where a password's needed to access the information. It's one of these things where, again, from a purely legal perspective, the law really hasn't developed firm guidelines and that sort of thing. But it comes down to, you know, from a prudent perspective, would I want that information, would I want my information on me personally posted in a public forum, and, you know, would I want to be asked and that sort of thing? And We obviously want to treat members of the congregation the same way we would want to be treated ourselves.
Great. Moving from the copyright, or from the privacy area, more back to our area of copyright. You know, today we hear a lot about fair use. What is exactly fair use, and does it really apply to what congregations might be using or doing?
Well, let me start. There are a number of misconceptions regarding the Internet, and you can talk to a lot of people who simply believe that anything that's on the Internet is fair to be used by anyone for any purpose. And let me just start by saying that is absolutely incorrect. Things that are posted on the Internet can be sometimes their use may be greatly restricted, but things that are posted on the Internet are in fact protected, for example, by the copyright laws, and you have to look to and actually do an analysis before you just take them and paste them into a presentation or put them on your website or put them in your newsletter. Generally speaking, when you're performing this sort of analysis, the concept of fair use is going to come up. Well, fair use is a concept that is legally part of our copyright laws, and it's very narrow. It basically deals with educational uses and doesn't, in fact, apply to most of the things a congregation would be doing either in their newsletter or on their website. Fair use just is frankly not really going to be applicable. There's some people say, well, fair use it simply means if you're not using it for a commercial purpose, and that is also incorrect. It is the copyright laws apply whether you're making money off of your use of a photo or a text-based article, or whether you're making money. It simply doesn't matter whether you're making money or not making money off of your use of the item. Copyright laws still apply. Fair use is not applicable.
We will continue this interview with Harvey in next week's episode of Wells Tech, where he continues to share with us his experiences related to copyright, privacy, and we begin to even touch on different considerations when you are broadcasting worship services. Well, Harvey certainly has a lot of background and information on copyright, and I know as I was listening to him talk, there's so many things to be concerned with. In copyright, it's very difficult, I would think, for a congregation to kind of know where to start.
Right. That's fascinating stuff. We're really blessed to be able to tap into Harvey and just kind of all get educated together about all the different facets of copyright.
And you know Harvey from a ways back, don't you?
That's right. We were members together at Emmanuel Lutheran in North Richland Hills, Texas. So got that Southern accent going.
Yeah, you outnumbered me on that interview. Let's turn now to our picks of the week. Sally, you have something for us this week?
I sure do, and it ties right in with the audio-video conversation we were having earlier, Martin. I wanted to point people to Audacity, which is a free audio editing software, and there are versions available for Mac, Windows, and Linux, and it will allow you to encode your audio files in MP3 format. You'll have to download a separate encoder for that process, but MP3 is the popular format for audio files on the web, and you can do all types of audio editing within the software, getting rid of background noises, cropping out things that you don't want to include in your recording, that kind of thing. It's really simple to get started with. You can find the software at audacity.sourceforge.net, and I'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes that we post at wellstech.wells.net. It is actually the tool we use for recording this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's a tool, you know, for the price, you certainly can't beat it. And for splicing together video or audio and the things that we need to do for this show for most purposes, if you're doing some recording of sermons or worship services, it should fill the bill. doesn't provide all the bells and whistles that, you know, some of the paid for programs will provide, but sometimes you really just don't need those. You just want to just get the job done. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sally. Great pick. My pick of the week is a software application, or actually it's on the web, but it acts like a software application. It's called Google Reader. I know that when the web was new to all of us, you know, many of us spent a lot of time going out to websites and surfing around, and we found, you know, our favorite websites, and we would bookmark them or mark them as favorites, and then we would revisit them on a fairly regular basis to see if there was anything new on them. But with the advent of things like Google Reader and the technology called RSS, really simple syndication, we now have the ability to take all those favorite websites and have that information delivered to us. So instead of going and seeing, it's a come and see kind of a strategy that RSS enables us to do. And Google Reader is just one of a number of programs that do that. It's a free application. Just go to Google. We'll put the link on the show notes. But essentially, it's a little application, allows you to tag favorite websites, and it will, like a newspaper style approach, feed down to you all of the new articles that are posted on those websites. So if you have a particular area of interest, you can tag those as feeds you want to be notified of. And then in the morning, just like when you read your morning newspaper, you can open up this application and read all of the new articles that are posted on those particular websites of interest. You can do it for, you know, sites like CNN or Headline News, you know, those kinds of things, or sports, or, you know, educational, religious, all those kinds of things can be added to the feed. And you can view it in an expanded view or a list view, so you can see them all in one screen, or you can see them, you know, in a linear fashion, just read one right after another after another. And they aggregate all those feeds into one view. So just kind of your little mini newspaper, just a great technology that's certainly a time saver for me, as I'm interested in especially technology topics as they relate to ministry. I can bring all of those types of feeds into one little reader, and I don't have to go out searching on the internet for these each and every time. So Google Reader is my pick of the week.
Very good.
Next is our Wells.net feature of the week. Sally, have you picked one this week?
Actually, I did. It's one of my favorite things. I like to refer to it as the treasure chest on Wells.net, because just loaded with great stuff. And that's the Wells.net Q&A, or question and answer area. You can get to it at wells.net/jump/QA. And there you're going to find an archive of over 8,000 previous questions and answers that were asked. It's searchable, and it covers a variety of topics, all different doctrinal and religious type topics, like questions about the triune God, about the Bible, about prayer, baptism, communion, fellowship with other congregations, questions about all different religions and how different religions compare to what we believe as Wells members. There's just a wonderful treasure chest, as I refer to it, of topics there. And you can use it in many different ways. Certainly you can ask your own questions if there's a question that you don't see covered in the archive. The website boasts about 20 or 30 new questions every week that are published in the Q&A. You can also use it for a Bible study tool. Perhaps you're looking into a topic that you want to discuss further in Bible class or study on your own. You can go out and search the Q&A tool and find just a wealth of knowledge on different biblical and doctrinal topics. And you can also display it on your own church website, which is a really cool feature because Wells.net does have RSS capabilities. You can actually pull in the most current questions and answers to your own church website, and it's dynamically updated. You're constantly getting new content without having to manage that area of your website, but linking to these great questions. I pulled up the current list of questions that are posted out there, and there's everything under the sun. Questions about playing the lottery, about false prophets, about the Book of Concord, about your conscience, about being saved, about particular biblical passages. just a great variety and wealth of knowledge that's available out on the Wells.net Q&A. Again, it's at wells.net/jump/QA, and we'll put that link in the show notes.
Great resource. In fact, one of the most, probably the most popular area of the Wells.net website. Gets a lot of traffic, a lot of use, and many uses, as you mentioned, Sally. So incredible resource. A lot of time and energy is put into answering those questions, and extremely well done. Valuable resource for individuals and for congregations. Thanks, Sally. Community feedback is next. Do we have anything from our listeners this week?
Yes, actually, again, out on the Wells Tech listserv, there's been a great conversation going on about mobile wireless computer labs for schools. Justin Ninman from St. Peter Elementary School in Appleton asked the question about getting started with a mobile wireless lab, and I was quite impressed with the answers he received, and I think you will be too. If this is something your school is considering, there's a lot of great information being shared out on the Wells Tech listserv, and I encourage you to check it out. We'll have a link to that conversation in our show notes.
Thanks, Sally. That will about do it for our show this week. As usual, we will close the show by featuring a Wells artist. The artist this week is Wendy Sue Fleege from her album The Instrument, the song by the same name. So let's listen to her sing The Instrument. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week. Is giving you